Today I'm going to be talking about the really the darkest period of the entire Cold War, I think, this great crisis of the winter of 1950-51 and its meaning for the whole story here. Actually, this is the first of a two-part lecture on the whole period from 1949 to 1954, which is a crucial period in the history of the Cold War. It's not just that the world moved into a very dark crisis, but eventually it came out the other end with what you might think of as something like a stable international system. The system that was established by the Paris Accords of 1954. I'm going to be talking about this at very great length. It's like before I started studying the Cold War, I never even heard of the Paris Accords. It turns out that they're of absolutely fundamental importance, as important for the history of the Cold War as the Versailles Settlement was for the period, for the interwar period. Why is this story important? It's like, because the Paris Accords, one might think, should have laid the basis for a stable international system. Right? A chance for peace. In fact, this was the third great point in the history of the post-World War II period where you might have thought that the basis for a stable East-West political relationship, the basis for a stable great power peace was being laid. First time, 1945, the understanding that Burns and Stalin had reached in the second half of 1945, first at Potsdam and then reaffirmed at the Moscow conference in December of 45. The whole notion of an amicable divorce, mutually acceptable division of Europe. They would call the shots in their part of Europe. We would control things in our part of Europe. On that basis, we should get along with each other. And then we looked at why that didn't work. That was how we framed the whole analysis of the coming of the Cold War in 1946. Here you have what you might think of as a political understanding. The two sides should have, accepted things in a, relatively friendly way. Why didn't it work? That question framed our analysis of the early Cold War period. Why didn't it work? Because Soviet actions on their southern border in the Near East against Turkey and Iran, triggered a security dilemma type mechanism. It's triggered the spiral of conflict. It meant to the Americans that you couldn't have a relatively friendly settlement. Ultimately, this settlement had to be based on power realities. That was the only thing the Soviets respected. This is why, Truman thought that Stalin's little crack at Potsdam about the Pope, how many divisions does he have, was so revealing. The only thing these guys respect is force, military power, right? Why were they moving against their South? Because the Americans hadn't made it clear that they were throwing their own power into the balance. It was just the British. The British were totally exhausted. It was only when the Americans in 1946 made it clear to the Soviets that this was a fighting issue that the Soviets drew back, right? And that led to this total transformation of American thinking about how we should proceed. We needed to generate power, countervailing power, to keep the Soviets at bay. You couldn't do this thing in a relatively friendly way. And to generate power, you had to mobilize the energies of your own people by over-defining the threat, making things, in Dean Acheson's famous phrase, clearer than the truth. And also taking actions that would draw the Germans into your sphere, because the basic strategy that you were pursuing was a strategy premised on the division of Germany. the creation of a West German state, you know, not a unified German state. So the fear was, oh, the Germans aren't going to like this. So you had to kind of outbid the Soviets. Point the finger at the Soviets. They're the great enemies of German national unity, not us. We basically support the right of self-determination. Right? Ignores the whole thrust of American policy at Potsdam and beyond. Okay? That was the way we framed that first chance for peace, 45, and then what happened in 46. And then, in the lecture last time, we looked at a second chance for peace. Okay, so there's this whole problem, the early Cold War. It's because the security dilemma is triggered. You have the spiral of reactions. Everything culminates in the Berlin blockade. Why was that important? Because it was the German question that was at play there. This was the way the Soviets had of forcing the Western powers to take their concerns about Germany seriously. You know, they didn't like the fact that the West was organizing West Germany against them, pointing the finger at them, suggesting that German national aspirations would be underwritten ultimately by Western military power. You know, going along with the resurgence of German power. You know, first, you know, getting the German economy back on its feet. You know, part that was a big part of the meaning of the Marshall Plan. And then setting up some sort of political structure within Germany. Ultimately, the creation of the Federal Republic of Germany, the West German state. Right? And then ultimately, the notion was, and this was, it was quite clear, this was implicit and sometimes explicit in the Western strategy for Germany, the creation of a West German army that would be integrated into the Western Bloc as a whole. Right? Soviets, these are deep sources of concern. So the Berlin blockade, on their part, should be understood in defensive terms. Right? Americans, are they aggressive? No, American policy is essentially defensive also. Right? We're not interested in throwing the Soviets out of Eastern Europe. We're interested in making sure that there's a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe by building up the overall power of the West, right? It's a policy that looks toward the stabilization of the status quo. Nevertheless, you could have a clash, a very serious clash that, you know, results from the confrontation of these two essentially defensive strategies. That's the security dilemma. Security dilemma in action. And then we saw how that ran its course. 1949, the Berlin blockade is ended. The West German state is created. The Soviets create their own state in East Germany, German Democratic Republic, it was called. NATO comes into being at about the same time, April 1949. Soviets ultimately respond by creating their own equivalent military organization in the East called the Warsaw Pact. Right? Formal structures are now in place. NATO, the two German states, and so on. Soviets seem to have signaled their acceptance of that new structure, a formally divided Europe, right? By ending the Berlin blockade. Second chance for peace, question mark. No, it doesn't work that way, right? Why did it fail? That question then serves as the framework for the analysis of the post-1949 period. Okay? Why did it fail? It failed for one basic reason. The Berlin blockade was ended. Level of tension was diminished for a while in early 1949. But this did not mean that a true political understanding had been reached. And you could only have a stable peace if the two sides agree in the political sphere, on what that they reach a political accommodation with each other. Right? The Soviets still were not, deep down, accepting what the Western powers were doing with Germany. This remained a very, very fundamental concern of theirs. Who could tell how far the Western strategy would go? Who could tell how much power the Germans would get? Who could tell what the Germans would do once they became strong? Or whether the Western powers might feel obliged, simply in order to keep the Germans in their camp, to underwrite these German national aspirations, right? Didn't it make sense for the Soviets to worry about these things? Again, purely defensive reasons. Didn't it make sense, therefore, for them to think in terms, maybe we gotta nip the problem in the bud. Maybe we can't wait until it gets totally out of hand, all right? So those concerns remain intact. But they don't lead to a confrontational policy. Why? Because the military environment at this point is such as to not make it possible for the Soviets to pursue, you know, a hardline confrontational policy. And what is the key military reality at this point? Americans don't have very much in terms of forces in being, you know, ground forces and so on. What we have is one big trump card. This is the nuclear monopoly. Nuclear monopoly was so important that it meant that we didn't really need a big military establishment in the late 1940s, you know? We could afford to reallocate our national energies away from the military and toward, you know, taking care of our own people. You know, this whole generation, you know, basically my parents' generation, the generation that fought World War II, these people, you know, they were beginning to, you know, buy homes in the suburbs and cars and refrigerators and a little later televisions. They wanted all this kind of material goodies that they hadn't had since the 1920s, basically. You know? And so there were big cuts in the military budget. You know, no one wanted to have a big standing army. The troops wanted to come home and so on. This phenomenal military machine that the United States had built up during the Second World War basically dismantled, almost overnight. By the end of 1946, you know, America didn't have a significant offensive military capability. Why could we do this? Because the war broke out. If a war broke out, we'd win in the end. We'd win with bombs and bombers that we would construct after the outbreak of the war. We didn't even have a substantial nuclear capability or an air atomic capability. Right? We, you know, a handful of bombs took a long time to assemble, you know. And then once you had them, you know, what, you know, you would have to worry about delivering them. How are you going to deliver them? Well, you needed to deliver them from bases relatively close to the Soviet Union if you're going to have an intensive bombing campaign. But those bases could be neutralized by Soviet ground forces fairly early on in the war. Then you'd have to fight the war with these intercontinental bombers. We only had a handful of them, these B-36s. Huge, huge bomber, huge aircraft. And then you'd have to kind of penetrate Soviet air defenses and big lumbering bombers that have traveled thousands of miles, you know, penetrate Soviet air defenses. Who even knew what targets to hit? You didn't have any decent intelligence. They had captured some aerial photography that the Germans had conducted during the war. That was about it in the late 1940s. You know, this meant that if a war broke out, in the words of an important American document from the late 1940s, we wouldn't be able to do more than bruise the Soviets in the initial attack. Why? You know, it's like, didn't these people know how powerful atomic bombs were? Yeah. Answer: they knew. They knew better than a lot of people today, because they knew that these early atomic bombs, you know, of the sort that had been dropped on Japan at the end of the war, you know, in the kiloton range, that is to say, equivalent to something like 12 to 20 thousand tons of of TNT. Right? These bombs were weapons of relatively limited power. Basically kind of they could level a square mile, something like that. You know, but you drop one of these bombs on, you could level UCLA and maybe adjoining parts of Westwood, but they're nothing like the bombs that would come online, by like 1954, these great thermonuclear explosives, which were 1,000 times as powerful as these early atomic bombs. With these hydrogen bombs, these thermonuclear explosives, two or three of these things could destroy even the largest metropolitan areas. These were really just enormously more powerful than the early atomic bombs. The meaning of this was that if a war was to be fought only with these early fission weapons, it would go on for a long time. A country could absorb thousands of these early atomic bombs and still survive as a functioning society. That was not to be the case with thermonuclear weapons. That's why I think of this whole period from 1945 to about 1954, 52, 54, is kind of the golden age of air power. Right? It was air power would still be the decisive weapon in a war. But numbers still mattered. Air defense still mattered. Where you base this your weapons still mattered because they would determine the intensity with which an air campaign would be fought. After 1954, when the thermonuclear weapons came online, these weapons, air power became the victim of its own astonishing technical success. These wars became largely unfightable. That was not the case in the early atomic age. You could fight a war basically with these fission weapons. You could absorb a large number of them. How many you absorb could be dramatically affected by such things as the intensity with which you can conduct a bombing campaign aimed at destroying the enemy's air atomic infrastructure, that's to say not just the nuclear forces in being and their delivery systems, but their production facilities, the factories producing the atomic bombs and the aircraft that would carry them. Right? This is numbers still matter. Right? So the United States had relatively few numbers. It was not eager to have a Third World War in the late 1940s, because even though the sense was, yes, we would win in the end, we'd be able to destroy the adversary in a war that might last for 5 to 10 years. With bombs and bombers produced after the outbreak of the war, with bases that we were able to reacquire on the periphery of the enemy after the outbreak of the war, with target intelligence that we were able to acquire after the outbreak of the war, but for the time being, no more than bruise the adversary. So it's not like we could look forward to a war with equanimity. It's not as though our nuclear forces would enable us to knock the enemy out at the very beginning of the war, and we could protect our allies in Western Europe that way, keep the enemy from overrunning Western Europe. No, we'd win in the end, but it'd be a Pyrrhic victory. Because Western Europe, our allies there, they would be destroyed in the process of our gaining that victory. So we were held back. It wasn't foolish on the part of Truman and Marshall to take a very cautious line in the Berlin Crisis. A lot of people think, America had the nuclear monopoly. We should have brandished this. The Soviets would have been deterred. Not as simple as that, okay? Soviets, for their part, they wouldn't want a war either, right? Because even though they would have initial gains, they knew they would lose in the end, as long as America had a nuclear monopoly. So both sides are held back. But this is a fragile military balance. It's really can break very easily as a result of one single event. What is that event? The breaking of the American nuclear monopoly. if the nuclear monopoly is the one thing that holds them back, then if we no longer have a nuclear monopoly, the whole equation becomes very different. All these things that didn't matter very much in the period of the American nuclear monopoly now matter a great deal. Right? Why? Because once both sides have the ability to produce atomic bombs, they have to worry about what the other side is going to do. Each side's goal is to regain an effective nuclear monopoly by destroying the enemy's air atomic infrastructure, right? And the faster you move against the enemy's nuclear production facilities, aircraft production facilities, bomb stockpiles, aircraft on the ground, is based on the ground, the less the enemy is going to be able to attack similar targets in your own homeland. And if you can protect your own air atomic infrastructure and build up your own air atomic forces, then you're going to be able to effectively destroy your adversary. Not only prevent your adversary from building bombs and bombers of his own, but then go on to destroy the enemy's entire economy with the atomic bombs that you build after the outbreak of the war. So there's going to be a race between the two sides. Who's going to destroy the other side's ability to generate nuclear forces most quickly? Right? And in such a race, all these things that didn't matter very much in the period of America's nuclear monopoly now mattered a great deal indeed. Right? All these things. What do I mean, all these things? Target intelligence? Do we know even where the Soviet nuclear facilities are? They know where the American nuclear facilities are. America's an open society. Right? In those days, aircraft that were flying across the country would point out, where the nuclear facilities was to the passengers on the plane is one of the sites that they should see along the way. I mean, this was a big advantage for the Soviets. We didn't have the target intelligence. The whole basing problem. Well, they'll be able to neutralize the bases that we had, for example, in the British Isles or the Cairo-Suez area or Okinawa. Very quickly at the outset of the war, then we would have whatever bombing we would do would be done with these handful of B-36s that we had. Even if you produce more of these things, you can conduct a much more intensive campaign, bombing campaign, from bases that are located close to their targets than if you had to rely on these intercontinental forces. And so. So there was a sense of, we may be vulnerable. People say, the Soviets didn't have the ability to strike the United States until the late 1950s. Not true. According to our best intelligence at the time, the Soviets were perfectly capable of attacking targets in the United States as early as 1950. They developed this, put it on the board. The American nuclear monopoly was broken on August 29th, 1949. That's one of the most important dates in the history of the post-war period. Right? And he said, why were people worried about this? Because the Soviets could attack the United States, targets within the continental United States, with bombers that they had produced on one-way missions. Right? The pilot would drop the bombs and then go on to fly the aircraft and then, say, bail out over Mexico or something like that. The Soviets were capable of doing this. How did they even have a bombing force? Well, during the war, the main American bomber of that period, B-29, one of these B-29s had to make a forced landing on Soviet territory. And the Soviets, they basically reverse engineered the plane. They looked, they built their own copy of the American B-29. So they had, in that way, constructed an effective bomber, which they could use to attack targets in the United States on one-way missions, right? What all this meant was, after the American nuclear monopoly was broken, it was by no means clear that the United States could take its sweet time and then produce bombs and bombers in a fairly leisurely way and then go on to win the war. Because we ourselves would be vulnerable to attack. And if the Soviets moved more quickly against us and were able to destroy targets within the United States more quickly than we could destroy equivalent targets in the Soviet Union, they would then go on to first develop a general nuclear superiority, air atomic superiority, which would enable them to then complete the defeat of the United States with bombs and bombers that they would build, which would subsequently be able to destroy America's whole economic infrastructure. Right? We might lose the war because all of these things still mattered. You know, it's not like the thermonuclear period. You know, the numbers of bombs still mattered. The effectiveness of air defense still mattered. We had bases still mattered. You know, the quality of target intelligence still mattered. Right? So the loss of the American nuclear monopoly was very important. It led people in the American government to worry about what would happen now that the United States was no longer assured of ultimate victory in a war. Yeah?
So on August 29th, that was when
August 29th was when the Soviets exploded their first nuclear device, right? This meant the American nuclear monopoly was now broken. And the political, first military, and then political consequences of this were quite clear to the United States, right? Because don't forget, the one thing that was holding the Soviets back, not a large American army in Western Europe or anything like that, it's like we had a tripwire strategy. Very, very small military force in the late 1940s. The one thing that was holding them back was the American nuclear monopoly. You break that nuclear monopoly, what's holding them back? And they have this big political incentive now to move ahead. This German thing, who can tell where it's going to go? Maybe you got to nip it in the bud. Maybe if there's going to be a confrontation with the West, maybe they should have it sooner rather than later, right? A window of opportunity was opening up for them, you see? This is what Stalin tells Mao in late 1950, the Chinese leader, Mao Zedong. He says, if war is inevitable, let it happen now, right? So the Soviets, for these structural reasons, you see, become more aggressive following the breaking of the American nuclear monopoly. It's expected on the part of American leaders that they will become more aggressive for precisely these reasons. There are kind of interesting documents from early 1950 making this kind of analysis. We expect them to become more aggressive. We don't know where it's going to happen. It could happen in Berlin, it could happen in Finland, it could happen in Iran or Turkey, all these places on the periphery. Or it could happen in Korea. And in the event, that's exactly where it did happen, right? Stalin, who had earlier held back the North Korean communists from attacking the South, now gave them the green light. The Americans had this kind of sense of weakness in this period. You know, even when the Americans had the nuclear monopoly, they were unwilling to make really hard and fast commitments. We withdrew from Korea. Right, the Secretary of State Acheson, he's Truman's Secretary of State for Truman's second term, 49 to 53. Acheson says that South Korea is outside America's defense perimeter. Early 1950. Why would he do this if America is so strong? Answer is they have the sense of American weakness. Soviets think risks are relatively limited. They're in a strong position to take a harder line because of the shift in the military balance. And they give the North Korean communists the green light. Kim Il-sung gets the green light, right? And so North Korea invades the South. The aggression is so blatant that the Americans intervene. They're able to kind of hold on in South Korea. And in fact, General MacArthur is able to kind of reverse the course of the war by landing in Incheon behind the North Koreans' lines. And then pretty soon, American armies are marching into North Korean territory toward the Chinese border at the Yalu River. And this leads to a Chinese, not a Soviet intervention in the war, I should say. Soviets intervene in a minor way by allowing Soviet aircraft to be used in support of the communists. But basically, it's the Chinese now, who in October and November of 1950 are willing to take on the Americans. And it says this is a much more serious act than the initial invasion of South Korea in June. So, you know, when they went in June, basically the Americans had said that we're not going to do anything. South Korea lies outside the American defense perimeter. This is like practically like an engraved invitation that you're sending, you're giving the communists to kind of move against the South Korea. When the Chinese intervened against America, they were under no such illusions. Here's China, you know, fresh from their victory in their own civil war, and they're taking on what was the strongest country in the world in terms of its mobilizable war potential. It's pretty amazing. Why was this? It's because the communist side is willing to take a much more aggressive line, willing to pursue a much riskier policy, a policy that could lead to a third world war, because they felt that if war broke out, they might well win. This is exactly the American calculation. If war breaks out, this is what General Bradley, who is he had been Army Chief of Staff, now he's Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says in the National Security Council in late 1950, he says, if war breaks out, we might well lose. In fact, we would probably lose. That was the assumption. So America is very cautious. This is why we don't expand the Korean War in 1950, 1951. The last thing we want to do is escalate the conflict and run the risk of a third world war at a time when we might well be defeated. Right? This is these are scary. These are very scary months. This period in the very end of 1950 and through the first few months of 1951. Because it did seem like the Soviets are poised on the brink, right? It did seem like the Americans are, you know, practically cowering in fear of what would happen, of how things could deteriorate. But not to the point where they're unwilling to take countermeasures. Because one of the most striking things about this period is that the U.S. government adopts an astonishing a rearmament program. This is embodied in an important document called NSC 68/4 of December of 1950, laying out the basis for a massive rearmament. You know, this is rearmament that is only a very, very small proportion of which is directly related to the Korean War. The bulk of it goes to building up America's overall military power, and especially America's nuclear power, right? It's like military spending increases by like a factor of four. You know, like during the Reagan period when the American military budget went up by 30, 40, 50% maybe, you know, people thought, oh, this is a massive American buildup. Nothing compared to, you know, building up by 300, 400%. It was astonishing, right? And it eventually led to a change in an utter transformation in the strategic balance. I give you like a little schematic representation of this in that little chart there. I'll talk about it in a minute. It's slow in coming. Why is it slow in coming? Because this is a period of dramatic change in military technology. above all in the nuclear area, because there is all these advances in bomb design, so that something called the yield to weight ratio. In other words, you for relatively light bombs now, you can get a lot in terms of explosive power. And what this means is that you don't need these huge, heavy bombers to deliver these bombs. They could be delivered in, medium bombers, which is much easier to produce, providing you could provide the basing facilities for them, much more effective way of delivering the nuclear attack. Not just that, but also they could be deployed on carrier-based aircraft that could, be sent to the periphery of the Soviet sphere. It's like a dramatic increase in the production of fissionable material thanks to advances in technology in that area as well. But the changes are not limited to the nuclear area. These are dramatic changes in military technology across the board, to a certain extent a result of these increases in military spending. For example, this is the period when we're really shifting from propeller-driven to jet-propelled aircraft. Changes in the beginnings of military electronics, and especially military computerization. Computers having been developed initially for military purposes during the war, now they're applied for the first time to a major defense program with the construction of the SAGE air defense system, 1954. The introduction of electronics, especially computerization, is going to ultimately transform the nature of warfare and have a huge impact on the course of the U.S.-Soviet relationship during the Cold War. Dramatic increases in intelligence technology, for example, our ability to kind of eavesdrop on what the Soviets are saying to each other. All these things are going on in this period, but they have two important effects. First, the short-term effect is it slows down the process whereby a decision to increase military spending will result ultimately in a transformation of the military balance, where the decision to increase spending will be converted ultimately into forces that are deployed to the field, military end products, right? Why is this? Because in World War II, when we went to war, basically you go to the auto factories in Detroit, and then you say, stop making passenger cars and start making Jeeps. Stop making trucks and start making tanks, that sort of thing. Very easy to kind of make that sort of conversion. You could do it practically overnight because the technology is essentially the same. Not so during a period of dramatic change in technology, when you have to kind of rethink the whole design of the assembly lines, the whole nature of the production process. Bring in all these engineers and all these machine tools to kind of re-equip the factories to kind of produce this much more modern equipment. This takes a lot longer to do, a lot longer for these end products to start flowing off the assembly lines and being deployed to the forces in the field. Right? So it takes a long time, not overnight, a long time for the balance to be shifted. Right? And it's only at the very end of the Truman period, late 1952, that you see a dramatic effect in terms of the transformation of the military balance. Okay, by the end of 52, talking about this stuff longer than I thought. By the end of 52, the balance is totally transformed. Okay, the Americans now have totally the upper hand. Why? Precisely because of the technological revolution that was going on at the time. The Soviets have huge, massive military equipment, but it's no match for what we have because it's all this old junk. It's totally obsolescent, right? Now the United States has total military superiority. By the end of the Truman period, America is stronger than it ever had been in relation to any foreign power. And this would continue for another few years to the early Eisenhower period. That period, say from 1952 to, I don't know, 1959 or so, this is the high point of American military power. We're stronger than we had been during the early Cold War, stronger than we would be during the later Cold War. And what this means is that the American government now has a free hand to kind of move ahead in terms of the shaping of the political structure that it would like to create between the United States and the West European allies. Okay, I want to give you the midterms back now, so let me stop there. And next time I'm going to be talking about the nature of the political system that's brought into being and what its political effects were.